Hey everybody, happy Scary Movie Month, and welcome once again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net, scary movie love for scary movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined for the, as always, for the first official podcast of Scary Movie Month by JB.
You know, Patrick, I'm strong as 25 ox. I bite when opportunity knocks.
Our first podcast is always our commentary. This year's commentary was on Pieces. Hopefully many of you enjoyed that this weekend.
I'm still trying to get the puzzle together. It's so hard with these goddamn rubber gloves on.
The tip is you got to start vagina first.
No.
And then work out from there.
The secret is to force it. You have to force it with your rubber-clad thumb.
There's nothing forced about Pieces. So hopefully you guys are enjoying that. If you haven't yet, like I said, it's available on Shudder. You can subscribe to Shudder for $5 a month just to see Pieces and hear our commentary. That $5 is worth it.
Rubber-clad thumb was the band I was in college. None of us ever quit our day jobs.
Like I said at the top of the show, it is Scary Movie Month, our month-long celebration of all things horror. As you guys probably know, we are doing the Scary Movie Challenge. This is our 7th Scary Movie Challenge. Every day in October, when you watch a scary movie, go to fthismovie.net and write a 7-word review of your scary movie. And we're going to read some of our favorites on the show in just a couple of minutes.
But first, settle a bet.
I will.
The first year.
The very first scary movie challenge.
How many total did we get?
It was like just over 100, I think.
Okay.
My goal was 100, and we did clear 100.
You have just settled a bet because...
Did you win?
I did.
Okay, good.
We started it on Saturday, and at the end of Saturday, which was day one, which was October 1st, we had 171, which I sort of cavalierly mentioned was more than we got the entire year the first time we did it.
Yes.
Someone, no names, disputed this fact.
No, we got to just over 100. It kind of started as a lark, and now it's like the thing that we build our year around.
And what was the total approximately last year?
I honestly have no idea. Somebody this weekend put it at somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000.
Okay, because I don't know if it was last year or the year before. I think I had the next day off. It was like 10:45, and we were so close to the next milestone. So I popped something in that was 71 minutes, and I put us over the top.
Nice.
I was so proud. I think it was a Bela Lugosi monogram programmer.
Those are usually pretty short. Tonight on the podcast, we are going to be talking about why we like horror movies.
And I'm specifically going to take issue with something you either said or wrote
recently. Okay, that's fine. So we'll get to that in a minute, apparently. We are going to read some of our favorite entries in the Scary Movie Challenge. We'll talk about some stuff that we've seen lately, maybe. And then we will talk about why horror movies. We are recording this on Sunday, October 2nd.
Yes.
It will post on Wednesday, October 5th.
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. So if you have posted something between like the night of October 2nd and October 5th, don't be depressed. Like, oh no, they're not going to read it. We may get to it on the next show. We only have the first 2 days really to go by.
Just be patient.
That's right.
This is something actually that a lot of horror films teach us. Horror films that aren't very good. Just be patient. Either A, something scary will happen in the last 10 minutes in the case of Giallo, or there'll be other films.
Right.
There'll be better films.
Right. So we've each chosen a couple that amused us thus far. J-Bones, I will let you.
I'm wondering if we're going to overlap.
We might.
We have the same taste.
Yeah.
In men. My first one is from friend of the site, Luke Ciancio, who talks about a film that's very close to my heart. The film is called Duel, the famous Steven Spielberg film. And his 7-word review is, remember, kids, to always pass with care.
Marcus Killerby says of Blood Rage, I can't believe it's not cranberry sauce. Now, that's very specific to anyone who has seen Blood Rage. But if you have seen Blood Rage, and by the way, you should see Blood Rage. That's an amazing 7-word review.
And I have not seen Blood Rage, so there goes another film on my list for this month.
You will hate it.
There are some months when I try. There are some months where I give up early. I am trying this month to do one a day.
All right, cool.
I have this pesky thing called a life, though, which keeps interfering.
As does everyone else.
Well, I'm not so sure, because I was looking at some of the reviews, and a couple
people...
It
was the weekend.
A couple people are like, boom, 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 and I am envious. Next, I have a twofer. We have two separate readers, listeners, commenting on the same film with two different seven-word reviews. First, we have Matthew LeBrum, who reviews The Shining by writing, room service for $2.37. Beer goggles, please.
I had that one.
And also JP, who's also a friend of the site, reviews The Shining and writes, why don't you have another drink, Dad?
Lindsay Wilkins of Christine. It's automatic, systematic, hydromatic, go, go, go.
I almost wrote that one down. Travis Larson, who reviews the 1986 David Cronenberg The Fly, thus, aw, what a sweet couple. Oh, shit.
Ross says of Wishmaster, walked out halfway through. Just kidding, Adam.
Yeah.
Which was funny in two ways.
I like that one a lot. Jason Stevens reviews the recent The Witch by writing, rabbits and rams lead to flying fun.
I have another one for The Witch from Alex Keel, who says, who let the titty-pecking crow in?
And that almost made my list, too. And then we have Brent Peterson, who reviews Pieces, a film that is now close to all of our hearts, by writing, Kendall touched me, and I liked it.
I was happy to see multiple. I might have one. I do. Okay, I won't spoil it yet. Grant Malfitano says of The Silence of the Lambs, I'm 33, still need help spelling Chianti.
We have very similar taste. All of yours I almost wrote down. And finally, and this is my favorite of this year so far, although we're only 2 days in, but this is terrific, and now I'm overselling it. Jeff Kalacki reviews The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from 1920 and writes, has Tim Burton seen any other movie? Nailed it!
Yeah.
Nailed it, Jeff!
Nick Robinson says of The Invitation, Norm Gunderson is a real wet blanket, which is another one of those that you have to have seen the movie. Our own Adam Risky says of In the Mouth of Madness, this weekend, Hobbs End Rib Fest, Apocalypse Monday, which made me laugh out loud. Dragpad says of 1931's Dracula, this guy is doing a terrible Dracudug. Our own Michael Pomero says of Tusk, Johnny Depp is unrecognizable as an iceberg.
Yeah, I like that one too.
Clint Jones, here's the Pieces one that I was thinking of. Mike Pence is a real dick, .. Which I was happy to see so many Mike Pence references in the Pieces were reviews.
And it made me really happy that a lot of people early on in Scary Movie Month were watching Pieces, listening to the commentary. There was actually one seven-word review from someone who was watching Sleepaway Camp.
Yep, and The Burning.
Listening to our commentary, yep. and checked it. So, you know, once you put these things out on the internet, it's like dick pics. They never go away. They're out there forever. They're evergreen.
Two more. J.M. Vargas of Adam Wingard's Blair Witch. We get it, Adam. Rent was overdue. And Rob DiCristino from F This Movie fame says of The Innkeepers, one star, definitely would not stay again, which I liked a lot. These are great. Keep them up. Again, we're only 2 days in, and we've just read a bunch of really, really terrific ones. So and you guys outdo yourselves every year.
The goal this year is 10,000.
Holy shit.
10,000. Seven-word reviews.
I feel like statistically we can't even make
that.
Well,
I'm mathematically figuring out how many that is per day.
Okay.
But I'm an English teacher, so I can't do that complicated. That would be like algebra. Like somewhere in the equation there'd be like a variable, like an x in parentheses.
I'm pretty sure it would just be 10,000 divided by 31, right? Wouldn't that give you the number?
Well, I would do 30 because that's easier because that ends in zero. So it's like it's like dividing 1,000 by 3. You drop the two zeros.
No, I'm going to let this play out.
And so it's about 333 a day.
Okay. So we're already way behind. Way behind, guys.
Not that far.
This was a Saturday and Sunday, and we didn't even clear 200 for either day.
You forget that the mania overtakes people as we get closer to the actual...
But you forget the massive dip in the middle.
Really?
It always starts... big.
Everyone starts with the best
and
intentions.
And then the diehards continue all month, and a bunch of people who were there early on kind of fade away and then maybe come back at the end like, I watched Halloween.
So what you're saying is the diehards continue and the tryhards.
Oh, you guys are not tryhards.
Drop away.
We appreciate every single review, even if it's just one. J-Bones, have you seen anything scary lately?
Have I seen anything scary lately? This is going to drop Wednesday.
Correct.
So you've already learned that the Pope is taking the month off because, as you might imagine, the Pope takes a very dim view of this celebration of Satan. So Halloween makes Jesus sad. Let me just say that. But I'm hoping that there will be more glutton for punishment reviews, because I've been trying to catch up on some very obscure horror films that you might be interested in. And I can promise you that glutton for punishment reviews of Night of the Lepus, which I have fairly constantly referenced on this podcast.
The first one of these, like our first Scary Movie Month podcast ever referenced,
right?
Night of the Lepus.
And that was like 5 years ago. When I brought it up, had you heard of it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I grew up, I had never seen it, and I still have never seen it. But I've grown up being aware of it, because it's like, oh, the Killer Rabbit movie.
Well, we're going to correct that.
Okay.
Because I have the Warner's Manufacturer on Demand, which I will let you borrow.
Thank
and you.
You
can make that one of your scary movie selections.
Thank you.
And then I think it's Kino keeps putting out all of these B-movie programmers that Bela Lugosi did, actually right after Dracula, when he was finding it hard to get work. And they're all terrific and all worth seeing. And I wasn't a glutton for punishment for that one at all. It's called The Death Kiss. And it's practically a Dracula reunion, because Lugosi's in it. Edward Van Sloan is in it. David Manners is in it. Tony Perkins' father shows up in it.
Is it possible that I got this disc to review and then gave it to you when I was done? Could this be my copy that I gave you?
Did you review it?
Yeah.
Is it about a murder at a movie studio?
Yeah.
They're filming a scene and the guy actually gets shot.
Yes.
Yes.
And I'd forgotten that I'd seen it until you said, it's a Dracula reunion. And I was like, wait a second, I've seen that movie.
And I was really impressed by it. And I don't want to give it away, but the film leads you down the primrose path of assuming that it's X, and then pulls the rug right out from under you. And not many films from the 30s can do that.
Yeah.
So the Pope's taking a break. Hopefully you can sate your soul with glutton. And those are the two scary movies I've seen lately.
I revisited Cat's Eye. When's the last time you saw Cat's Eye?
Probably the weekend it opened.
Okay.
I've only seen that once.
Okay. It's an anthology from like 83, 84 maybe, directed by Louis Teague.
It's canon, right?
No. Warner Brothers.
Okay. I assume they had some sort of thing where they hired Drew Barrymore for like multiple films. And in my imagination, Firestarter was one.
Which is Universal.
And
Cat's Eye.
So neither of them is canon.
Sadly,
so I
no.
know what I'm talking
Sadly,
about.
No. So it's three Stephen King short stories. He actually wrote the screenplay. I hadn't seen it in years. Warner Brothers just put it out on Blu-ray along with Salem's Lot and It. All three of those just came out on Blu-ray, which you can find fairly inexpensively if you can find them at all. People have been struggling to find them in stores. Amazon wasn't carrying them. It was a very strange thing.
They had sent me one of those emails. You buy an awful lot, John, but you don't buy enough. And the price for It was fairly expensive. I was
well. There's two versions. One has like a T-shirt and something, because I bought it for less than $10. So
because there's a version of The Shining coming out for Halloween with a T-shirt too. I don't need a T-shirt.
Enough already.
Don't have my size,
right?
So without a T-shirt, is it just normal price for a Blu-ray?
Yeah, it was like less. It was like $8.
Because I wanted to pick that up.
Yeah.
And now Cat's Eye. Let me see if I remember this.
All right.
The touchstone sequence is Drew Barrymore, and there's that little troll.
That's the third sequence,
right?
Yes.
That's clearly
kind of ripped off
to
from
be
Trilogy of Terror,
the climax,
right?
And then the one I remember better than all three is Quitter's Ink,
yeah.
Which I always thought they made a big mistake in Cat's Eye, kind of halfway playing for laughs.
Quitter's Ink,
yeah.
If they're laughs, they're dark laughs. It's not broadly comic at all.
Because I always thought they needed to go darker with that.
It's pretty dark.
Because the concept is
yeah. It's pretty dark.
I remember the little what's the official horror movie word for the last little?
Right.
That is right. But maybe it's the fact that Alan King.
Yeah, but he's not playing it funny.
When did it come out?
83, 84, maybe.
Okay,
it's been a long time. Yeah,
I'm not remembering.
The movie was actually better than I remembered it being. And just as a Stephen King fan, I mean, there's little fan service at the end because it's the cat is the connecting sequence.
Right.
It runs through all the stories, and at the very beginning, it's getting chased by a giant Saint Bernard, and it runs right in front of a Plymouth Fury, and there's all these little Stephen King references, which are fun. Quitters Inc. is great. James Woods is great in it. The second sequence is a lot of fun. That's Robert Hayes from Airplane, where he has to walk around the ledge.
Oh, yeah, I like that one a lot.
Really fun. And then the third sequence is by far the weakest, which is just Drew Barrymore being tormented by this little troll, and the troll is fighting the cat, and it's not particularly good. And I think the movie ends on kind of a bum note. The one thing I will say about that sequence that I completely forgot is because of the way that Lewis Teague shot it, he did a lot of like rear projection and optical effects. And so the little guy is a person in a suit that they make to appear very small with optical effects. And so it looks amazing because you can tell when it's a puppet versus when it's a real person that's moving inside that thing. And so it looks incredible. It's like one of the best versions of that effect ever, because every other movie would just do it as a little puppet. Nothing against puppets. I love puppets, but the effect is incredible. The story itself is not great.
I remember the effect, and a lot of it is the mask and the costume,
sure,
which I think work really well.
Yeah.
So why isn't that talked about more? It's sort of been...
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it just kind of got forgotten because there were a lot of Stephen King movies coming out around that time, and maybe it just kind of fell by the wayside and gets written off as kind of one of the bad Stephen King movies, but I think...
Well, I remember the Robert Hayes sequence. I thought... looked and sounded like an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Yeah.
That was really self-contained and sort of, you know, that the bad guy gets his comeuppance.
Right.
One of those sort of EC Comics stories.
Yeah, it's fun. And that one's, you know, fairly dark as well. I think that one's a little bit more comedic, but it's has kind of some dark moments. I also watched for the first time, and I've been hearing about this movie for a few years, the WNUF Halloween special. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
Have you seen it?
Yes.
Okay. It's on Shudder, and I'm super glad I watched it. I was very entertained by it. I just was struggling with this idea of, like, does this have any replay value? Because the conceit is it's essentially a VHS tape of a local news station broadcasting on Halloween night. A guy's going into a haunted, you know, a house that's supposedly haunted, and there's a bunch of like local commercials that run through the whole thing. It's amazingly constructed. I mean, it feels so authentic. But beyond that, I'm like, but what am I watching? Do you know what I mean? So it's like, I don't want to reduce it to calling it a stunt, because
that they did an amazing job of recreating this thing, but to what end?
Yeah, sort of. Again, I was entertained by it. I would tell people to watch it at least once. I'm not trying to critique it, but I really was trying to wrap my head around, like, but why? Like, what? And part of me was wishing that the actual news broadcast stuff had gotten, like, really scary and really dark. Yeah, and it never quite does.
That's where it seems to be going.
Yeah.
Was there a time when they were marketing that on VHS as kind of a nostalgia item that you can actually buy it on VHS tape?
I'm pretty sure, but I'm not positive.
Because I first saw that on YouTube.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which sort of added another layer of...
Right.
I don't even have a word for it. It's supposed to look like an old crappy VHS tape.
And it does.
And I'm watching it on a postage stamp size screen on probably a bad internet connection.
And the guy they got to play the reporter, I mean, he's right on. I mean, it's amazingly well done. I just don't know if there's anything to bring me back other than, like, oh my gosh, can you believe someone did this? You know what I mean?
Right. So you're saying you could do it. But should you have done it?
I'm fine that someone did, but now that someone has, I feel like nobody else ever has to do anything like this. I'm not all the way through the movie yet, so maybe I'll talk about this on the next podcast, but our regular listener and friend Chaby had recommended a movie to me called Francesca, which is, you know, a current movie that really approximates a 1970s giallo film. And I haven't finished the movie. It does it very, very well, but I bring the same thing up. Like, okay, I'm impressed that you could do this. This is very faithful. This looks like the thing, but is looking like the thing enough?
And there was recently another film like that.
The Editor, is that what you're thinking of?
No.
Okay. The Editor is almost like a spoof, so that has something else going for it on top of the faithfulness.
This played at the Music Box as a midnight show. I don't think that's the way I saw it. I think I got a hold of a disc, but it, for all the world, looked like a stylish 70s horror film on Cinemax. And it was about vampires, a female vampire. And most of it took place in this house. And I wish I could remember the name, because everyone I know who saw it.
The one with Milo Ventimiglia? Rocky's son?
Almost everyone I know who saw it, and I swear I think you saw it, said, boy, that was a real close approximation of sort of this 70s Euro trash.
Yeah, it felt like a Jean Roland movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just brought it up on the show last week, and now I can't remember the name of it, so I'm trying to look it up as we are talking about it. This is very upsetting, because
could the title
kiss,
be a character?
Something Kiss.
Kiss of the Vampire?
Kiss of the Damned? Kiss of the Damned.
I think it's Kiss of the Damned.
Kiss of the Damned.
Okay, now, the fact that neither of us could remember the title
I liked the movie.
So did I. I liked it a lot. And you know what? I think I first saw it at midnight at the Music Box.
Maybe.
Which added another layer of decadent European trash talk.
Jess Franco. The last movie, well, I yesterday afternoon had some time alone with my son because my wife and my daughter were out, so we came down to our basement and watched Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, which was his first time seeing it beginning to end, and that
yes.
was fun. He likes it when Frankenstein throws the woman out the window. That was his response.
And that was your your 7-word review was a sly reference to that.
Yeah.
Lenore Albert, Meet the Window.
The last movie that I'll mention is I watched a movie yesterday called, I'm not positive I'm saying it right, Kuroneko. It's a Japanese film from 1968, and it is about these samurai who happen upon like a hut where these two women are, and they proceed to rape and kill these two women, and the women are essentially brought back to life by demon cats, sort of, and that's all in the first 10 minutes. And so the movie is beautiful and weird and haunting and so compelling, and you can't ever anticipate where it's going to go, even if you, I mean, how could you, when that's the first 10 minutes, how could you say, I know how this is going
to
turn out?
And at this point, I must point out to our listeners that Patrick dreamed this movie. This is not, don't bother looking it up or trying to buy it. The fact
it's on
that you
Criterion.
Keep hope. Wait, what is it called?
Kuroneko?
Why doesn't that?
I don't know. It's a Criterion film. They put it out on Blu-ray fairly recently. Anyway, it's on Hulu streaming if you're a Hulu
and
subscriber.
And you recommend it?
I 100% recommend it. I think it's terrific. Really weird and creepy, kind of a ghost story.
I was going to say, it sounds like The Virgin Spring with ghosts.
Yeah, I mean, the way that they handle the ghosts is really interesting. And again, there are all these developments that you're like, well, I didn't see that coming.
Is it better than Houssou?
Very different. Very different. Kind of a classier Houssou, but Houssou is fun.
I'm gonna add that to my list. That sounds really great.
It is. And that's it for me. So, let's talk about why horror movies. Now, I was going to call this podcast Why Horror, but I can't because there's this documentary that shows up on Showtime called Why Horror, where it's a guy walking around being like, why horror movies? And they don't ever actually answer the question. And spoilers, either will I, but so I got to come up with another name for the episode.
Okay.
Maybe Demon Cat?
J-Horror is taken.
Yeah.
We can't use Y horror.
Right.
F horror, but that's a trope that you used to use a lot and you wanted to get away from that trope.
No more of that.
So I can't remember if it was a podcast or something that you wrote I believe it was something that you wrote, and it made my jaw drop.
All right.
And I kept reading the sentence over and over and over again. And I was just going to confront you directly at one of our AA meetings that we attend, but I decided to wait because I thought it would make a good podcast. You said, I'm paraphrasing, I don't watch horror movies to get scared.
Yeah, this is something I've been saying for years. Years ago, Doug and I, during a scary movie month, we did like a back and forth column, and it was essentially what do you want out of a horror movie? And Doug's answer was to be scared, and mine was, that's not why I watch them. Now, the problem is I don't have a substitute answer. I don't have a here's why I watch them. And I've thought about it because, and I think I've said this before, horror is the only genre that you have to defend to people. It's the only one where someone will say, why do you like this stuff? Nobody says that about comedies. Nobody says that about dramas. Nobody even says it really about Westerns or whatever. It's just horror. Why do you like this?
I don't want to engage in snotty-nosed debate here.
Okay.
But the more I thought about it today, because I knew we were going to have this discussion, and I have several options written on this piece of paper that might be the answer to why I primarily go to horror movies to get scared.
Okay.
I like to get scared.
Okay.
I like that feeling. I think a lot of horror fans were traumatized at an early age, many of them from stories I've heard by fathers who were far too, what's the word I'm looking for? Who so desperately wanted to share this thing that they loved that they encouraged / made some kids watch things way too young.
Sure.
And that some of us reacted to the trauma of this is scaring the shit out of me and I can't handle it by becoming an adult, one of whose pleasures in life is being the master of this stuff, that I'm sort of psychically trying to make up for the fact that this scarred me as a young child by showing that I have domain over it. But you said horror is the only genre that you have to defend. But I don't think that's true.
Okay.
I think it's also true of pornography.
Okay.
And I'm not making that comparison lightly because there are some genres, I feel, that we enjoy and appreciate in our heads.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other genres that we enjoy and we appreciate with our bodies.
Okay.
And the body genres are comedy. It elicits a physical reaction that you can witness.
Right.
Tear jerkers, heavy dramas, anything that is designed to make you cry.
Right.
Tragedies, let's call them. Horror films, where on a certain level, if it's working, you will jump back. Your eyes will grow wide. You will make a noise. You will leave the theater. And pornography, which has its own physical reactions. So I think that's a useful way to frame the discussion. Wouldn't you agree that, except maybe for Westerns, the four most popular genres of film are the ones that elicit a physical reaction rather than
just
a mental reaction?
Yeah. I think because they're, in some ways, the most universal in terms of what we want out of something, art or entertainment. At the same time, they're more subjective than almost anything else, because what is funny and what is scary and what is sexy.
No, I completely agree.
Is a totally subjective. I'm not against being scared in a horror movie. I'm not like, don't scare me, horror movies. And in no way am I coming off or trying to come off like the guy who can't be scared. That's not what I'm trying to say at all. Like, these movies don't scare me. I'm too good for that, or I'm above it.
No. I understand that's not what you're saying.
It's just not. It's not necessarily what I'm looking for.
But let's use an analogy, because I think both of us are capable of going to a comedy where perhaps we don't laugh once, but we might agree it's a good comedy.
Sure.
And certainly comedy, like horror, the first time you see it is the bellwether, because it's never going to be that funny or that scary again.
Right.
It's repeating a joke. But I think the same is true of comedy. If I go to a comedy and I don't laugh once, that's going to be a mark against it. One of the things I like so much about Popstar, which interestingly enough is starting to get all of this buzz.
As I knew that it would.
3 months after it left.
Because everybody skipped it in theaters and now is catching up with it. And like, oh shit, this is actually funny. Same thing happened with Hot Rod, same thing, whatever.
That movie, for all of its flaws or supposed flaws, made me laugh.
Lots of jokes.
A lot.
Lots of funny jokes.
You got to like a show with jokes. What was on the other night? We were watching something on the television and...
The television?
Well, no, I've told you this before, right? I now put the word the in front of any technological term to make me sound older. Oh, the Facebook? The Google machine. You got that on the Twitter. We were watching Naked Gun 2.5.
Okay.
This was on Turner Classic Movies, which kind of threw me for a loop. Their definition of classic has really gotten very loose in the last couple of years.
Certainly more than American movie classics or the Independent Film Channel.
Are you old enough to remember
what
AMC once?
Yes.
Oh, my God. How the mighty have fallen. We're watching Naked Gun 2.5, and of course I've seen it before, but I'm just marveling at the rapidity of the jokes. Mm-hmm. Oh, you don't like this one? Well, hold on. There's one coming up in 30 seconds that is just constant. So I have to include if it made me laugh as part of my evaluation of the film, as I do with horror. And I've come to the conclusion that I've completely missed the boat on The Witch. I think you phrased it very well, that it is very well done, that you can point to the acting or the framing or the cinematography or the dialogue or even the special effects and say, this is a superior film. It's just not for you.
Right.
And my number one objection to the film was it didn't scare me. And part of the problem with that was it was being built up as, yet again, the scariest movie of the last 10 years, which is becoming the bellwether. But you see a horror film for the first time. And it doesn't scare you at all. Isn't that going to contribute to your aesthetic judgment? Or is that completely off the table?
It's completely off the table. If it scares me, fine, cool. That's maybe points for it, you know? Unless it's, and this is stupid, but something like Lights Out, which exists just to make you jump five or six times.
Sure.
Even if it does make me jump five or six times, that's not going to confuse me and make me say, like, well, that was good because I jumped five or six times.
Right, but it's not as if I'm... it's not as if I'm basing my star rating...
No, of course you're not. No. That was half of a point.
Okay.
That was half the point
I'm
I was
sorry,
making.
Because I'm comparing it to the doctor when he hits your knee.
Right. Right, exactly.
That clearly, if they do it too many times, then you're like, well, what is this?
Right. I have seen most of my favorite horror movies in recent years. A couple weeks ago, I went to the Bruce Campbell Horror Film Festival and saw a handful of movies, saw Found Footage 3D, really liked that. Saw Beyond the Gates, loved that. Saw I'm Not a Serial Killer, loved that. Not one of them scared me at all. And that's okay, because there were other things that I loved about them. I loved the characters. I loved the story that was being told. I loved the sense of humor. I loved, you know what I mean? The fact that it took place within the horror genre framework makes me love it that much more, because it's using things that I respond to, whether it's monsters or gore gags or specific lighting or whatever. That's the shit I like, so I'm automatically drawn to it more. But if it doesn't scare me, that's not a strike against it.
And I only saw I Am Not a Serial Killer on your recommendation and loved it very much.
I'm happy to hear that.
But there were a whole bunch of things in that film that honestly scared me.
Okay.
And here we, I'm going to take out the giant size can opener. And
okay.
Here's the can of worms.
Okay.
Gross. Theater of the mind.
Yeah.
That we could even start to debate what the word scare means.
Sure.
So there's the knee-jerk jump scare of Lights Out, which is fairly easy to achieve, but I never grow tired of it. I love when films do that. But there's also that sense of creepy foreboding,
mm-hmm,
that you carry with you out of the theater. the example I used for years and years was the first season of David Lynch's Twin Peaks, mm-hmm. that when the show was over, the show wasn't over.
Right.
Because you were still carrying it in your head.
Well, look at It Follows from 2 years ago. It has a couple of great jump scares, but what it really is the thing that you carry away when you walk out of the theater and you're suddenly looking around you on an empty street.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that movie does both.
And I will cop to the fact that I completely missed the boat on It Follows, I think because of the conditions under which I saw the first screening, and then gradually saw it two more times and recognized it for what it is. I'm wondering if two more screenings of The Witch would do the same thing to me.
Maybe. I haven't rewatched it either. I plan to, because I feel like I should, because I feel the same way, like I missed the boat. And I appreciate the fact that you're willing to give something a second chance, you know, because a lot of people aren't.
I need to screen The Goat and arrange it so that friends or family members furtively wait for me to go to the bathroom. And when I walk back into the family room, there's a really old goat sitting there.
Do you mean the witch? You called it the goat.
No, what's the goat's name?
Black Phillip.
That's...
No, when you said I need to screen, you said I need to screen the goat. You called the movie The Goat. It's no big deal.
I'm sorry.
Black Phillip is awesome, though, and the payoff.
Oh
to
no,
Black,
everyone!
The payoff to Black Phillip is incredible.
Everyone loves Black Phillip.
Yes.
I remember when more and more people started to see it.
Yeah.
When it opened wide, oh, all the talk was about Black Phillip.
You've already summed up my feelings on The Witch, but the shot, and I don't want to spoil it, but the shot of all of the wood. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
It's like one of the most powerful images I've seen in a movie this year.
You mean at the end?
Yes.
Because
it says everything about everything.
Patrick has so hypnotized me that very often my response...
Usually when I say shot of the wood, he thinks I mean dick pic. Did you see that shot of the wood?
I think you mean shadow
Stop
of the dick pic.
Stop texting me dick pic.
Don't you mean dick shadow?
Yeah.
Which I believe is a Cat Stevens song.
Dick Shadow.
He doesn't sing that song anymore because it's now against his religion. That sometimes I will respond to something with something you said, as my son is not shy about pointing out. I much prefer to quote other people than to come up with original thoughts or ideas or verbiage. And when I got to the shot that you're referencing, I thought narrative-wise, it was a mistake, and it leads to one of my problems with the film.
Okay.
That it bends over backwards to convince us that it's historically accurate.
Okay.
Because of the language and the times and the costumes.
Yeah.
But that is clearly trying to make audiences think that it is true to something that actually happened.
Sure.
And if that's the case, given what happens at the end of The Witch, I need to rethink my entire view of the universe and the way the world works.
Right.
But when I got to the shot that you're referencing, my first reaction was, you have to give them credit. They commit to the bit.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I don't know. I was not turned on to horror as a kid. It was something I discovered on my own, and my earliest memories are of finding this series of books at the library, checking them out in a constant rotation, just being drawn to the monster makeups, specifically the Wolfman and Frederick March in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
And I think we may have discussed this before. Used copies of those books are fetching enormous prices, and libraries, specifically school libraries nationwide, are scratching their heads at what happened to these books because they just walked out one day for people to post them on eBay. I think I showed you some enterprising publisher came out with sort of a new version.
Yeah.
And they're reasonably priced. I actually got a hold of one of the original books that you're talking about at a fairly decent price, and I hold it close to my heart because I wonder for how many kids were those books
the gateway drug. Absolutely.
And also, and I've probably bored our listeners with this before, when I was a child, I thought as a child, I spake as, no wait, as when I was a child, there were some films that were really hard to see, so you had to sate yourself on Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine or these books that you could get a hold of. And right. then once a year on the ABC yeah. Channel 7 3:30 movie, it was Monster Week, and that's when you got your fix. But they cut a half an hour out of the movie to make room for commercials.
Did those monsters scare me as a kid? Maybe. I honestly can't remember. The scariest things I remember as a kid, the most I remember being scared of horror movies was when other people would describe them to me. So I remember my brother describing to me the scene in Fright Night when Amanda Bierce is crying and says, "You promised," and she pulls her head up and she's just all mouth and teeth, right? He described it to me and it terrified me so much in my brain that I was scared to see it in the movie. I was prepared to like run out of the room.
And that's such a famous image. That's yeah, that's the poster.
That's the poster, yeah. Right. A friend, when I was way too young, describing Johnny Depp getting pulled into the bed in Nightmare on Elm Street and the amount of blood that shot out of the bed was so much scarier to me when I was trying to anticipate it and picture it. And then when I saw it, I was like, oh, well, that's not so bad. That I can handle. Those were the scariest things to me as a kid. And now, again, as an adult, if I see The Descent, the thing like, so I think The Descent is the scariest horror movie of the 2000s, just for pure scares.
I would tend to agree with you.
It's not a movie I revisit that often.
But that's another phenomenon, and that's in every genre.
Okay.
That there are definitely some films where you're one and done. There are films I have seen, and there's no compelling reason to revisit them.
Right.
That doesn't make them any less.
Exactly.
But there are some films that stand up to repeated viewings better than others.
So how many, I mean, horror is your favorite genre. How many times do you go see a horror movie and get scared?
I would say always.
Okay.
Because I would have to say I've seen the 1931 Dracula at least 75 times. Sure. That's a conservative estimate.
Sure.
And we talked about this when they put out the restorations, that when I watched the restoration, it was like watching something brand new because yeah. all of a sudden it didn't look like someone had Xeroxed the film. You know, suddenly at the beginning you could tell there was water running down those steps and you had never noticed that before. But except for the, oh, I've seen this so many times, I could tell you what looks better, there are things in that film that still scare me. It's not a jump scare, but I think I saw Dracula again maybe 2 weeks ago. Dwight Fry's laugh when they open the big doors of the boat.
Yeah.
And he's down there. Oh, he's crazy. That still scares me.
Okay.
A lot of Bela Lugosi's lines still scare me.
So do we just have different thresholds for what is scary?
But that almost makes it sound like you have a stronger constitution.
Which I'm not trying to suggest.
And I'm constantly scaring myself because I'm a baby.
Like I said, I'm not trying to position
myself. On a film
myself.
That some people would say that the 1931 Dracula can't scare a 2-year-old anymore.
This, by the way, there's a real movement now that all of a sudden, like, Dracula's not that great, and it's making me crazy.
Well, you know it's a pendulum.
I know.
And it fell out of favor, and then some time went by, and I would say the restoration went a long way. And even I was in that camp, that when they did the restoration, I watched it again with new eyes and sort of revised some of my previous opinions. Because back when it looked like shit and sounded like shit, that middle hour was hard to get through.
Sure.
And I thought that again when TCM did that crazy double feature where they showed the Spanish Dracula yeah. and then the Bela Lugosi one. And because the Spanish Dracula is longer and they showed it first, once again, I thought the middle hour of the Bela Lugosi one was hard to get through. But that's because it's 9:30 on a school night
right.
and I've had enough of this film that I've seen 75 times before.
Right.
You will admit there's different scares.
Of course.
Because something you said earlier reminded me of something that Stephen King brings up in a book that I read at least every 2 years. It's so great, Dance Macabre.
When I was talking about picturing stuff as my friends were telling me about it, he's talking about the bug on the other side of the door,
right,
or whatever.
Yeah, that, yeah, what you can imagine is always scarier than anything a filmmaker can show you. Very good you put that together. Because you've read the book several times.
Sure.
Did you know that there's several different forewords for different editions?
I believe I did know that.
Because I downloaded it for the Kindle, and there's a 2010
where
intro.
He talks about how much he loves the Last House on the Left remake.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has crazy taste sometimes.
Like, but he talks about other more recent horror films that he loved, with specific attention to Blair Witch, because you're talking about the Pendulum of Dracula. Can we talk about the Pendulum of Blair Witch?
Sure.
That movie affected me in a way that no other horror film had ever affected me.
Yeah.
And I'm not Pollyanna, where I've heard a rumor on this brand new thing called the internet that this actually happened. I wasn't in that camp.
Right.
I knew it was fiction. I knew it was a film. I was glad that I saw it fairly early on. I think I drove down to the Biograph to see it before. I'm sorry, Piper's Alley.
Yeah.
Before it opened wide, because I wanted to see it early. And there's still images from that film that really bother me. So in that sense, this, the extent to which I'm bothered is what I'm defining as scary.
Which I would agree with, that a movie like The Descent or a movie like The Blair Witch, I think, reach the upper echelon of modern horror films, specifically because they are scary. You know, Blair Witch doesn't have those things going for it for me. Like, I don't return to it for the characters or the dialogue or anything like that. The reason it exists in my head as a success, as a good horror film, is because it was scary. But it doesn't have to be that, is all I'm saying.
Okay. And I have never seen it again.
I might have. I think I've seen it one other time.
I've only seen it once.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to start that shit again. Because I think it was a couple months before I was able to get one image from that film out of my head. And I just don't need that baggage.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Plus, as I'm constantly telling my students, certainly there's some films that we love and it's really a lot of fun to revisit them. But wouldn't you frequently want to watch something new?
Yes.
Although I apply this more to remakes and sequels, that you know the chances of those being good is very low, so I'd rather see something new again, although Scary Movie Month, I think, has an amount of nostalgia attached to it.
Yeah, of course.
That people revisit old favorites.
I try to mix up, you know, stuff I've never seen with stuff that I like, some stuff that I didn't like that I'm just trying to see again. Today I watched 2000 Maniacs because I'd never seen it, in honor of the late Herschel Gordon Lewis. It's again, it's one of these things where it's like, I get it. I understand his importance. I appreciate what he did for the genre. His movies thus far have not been for me.
Although I think you, regardless of your aesthetic opinion of the film, you have to say hats off to the sort of peppiness and exuberance of 2000 Maniacs.
Sure.
Because Blood Feast is...
I've never seen Blood
Feast. It's a slog.
But I have seen The Wizard of Gore.
So, I forget the company. Could it be Arrow?
It's Arrow, yeah.
Has this crazy Herschel Gordon Lewis box coming out, and the extra expensive one comes with an eyeball and all this nutty stuff. And that sold out instantly, so... I ordered
and it was released right before he died.
Right. Yeah. I ordered the less expensive one, which is still way too much, because like one of the features of the 17 disc set is that you get everything in DVD and Blu-ray. Hey, I got news for you. Why not? So for the last couple days, my finger keeps hovering on the order history page at Amazon. Do I want to cancel this order?
Yeah.
Do I want to cancel this? Because I have the Blood Trilogy on Blu-ray.
Right. And I saw Amazon was selling like just the discs the other day for, I think, $150 was the collection for like one day.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously I don't have $150 to spend on that, but part of me is like, oh, but it's horror history and this is important. But am I ever going to watch all of those? No, so I didn't buy it.
I haven't pulled the trigger yet, and by pull the trigger, I mean
kill yourself.
I haven't canceled pulling the trigger,
right?
Because I pulled the trigger to buy it. So this is very instructive, because what you just said speaks volumes.
Okay.
That you're not, I don't want to paraphrase you incorrectly, you're not there primarily to get scared.
Right.
It's great if you do.
Sure.
But that in some sense, it has to figure into your judgment of the film.
Again, I don't think it does, because I'll bring up Beyond the Gates again, because it's a horror movie that I just saw recently that I really, really liked and was never scary to me. And I'm not even positive, like, was really going for scares. I think there's enough horror movies that are... Cabin in the Woods. Is Cabin in the Woods scary?
That's a good question, but I think, and I'm not trying to avoid answering it, it's compounded by the fact that it's also partially winkety-wink. It's
right.
also partially an homage.
Right.
It's also partially
sure.
a parody.
Sure.
There were a couple things in the glass boxes I thought was scary. When they all get loose, I thought that was scary.
And that was one of the main objections to the people who didn't like it was... Hey, it wasn't scary. And my response was always like, yeah, but so what? Because it was all these other things, and aren't all these other things great?
And as we know, scary and funny is really hard to do. Very few people have accomplished that. So if you're not primarily going to a horror film to get scared, and I have to say, I'm in Doug's camp. I'm there to get scared.
Yeah.
And you can define that in several different ways, but I'm there to get scared. If you're not there to get scared, why are you there?
Well, that's the question that I said I don't know that I can answer. It pushes other buttons that I have that have always interested me. I like being in the universe of horror. Horror is able to do... the thing that I tried to kind of nail down in this conversation with Doug, and I don't remember exactly how I... phrased it, was that I'm much more drawn to a horror movie with crazy imagination that can show and do things that don't exist in reality, more so than one that is out to scare me. So Doug and I are always on opposite sides of this spectrum, because he's all about The Haunting and The Others and movies that don't show much, and they're just about like creaking doorways and dark halls and things like that.
And I love those as well, but it almost sounds like you're saying, and this is something I talk about endlessly, that for some reason realism becomes the dominant style in American film. Maybe because their narrative, maybe because people like a nice story. There's lots of different reasons. But you will admit that there are lots and lots of people who hold that up as one of their number one criteria.
Sure.
It seemed like it was real.
Right.
And like the musical, horror films don't feel as bound to that.
Right.
So you're drawn to them because they're willing to stretch the imagination.
Yeah.
Also, they're able to deal with things that people might not be able to deal with if it wasn't in a fantasy construct. I'm thinking of several Twilight Zone episodes that deal pretty explicitly with adult matters, but it's okay because it was aliens
right,
who turned off
right.
the lights. So we allow that to be on TV in the 50s because, you know, it's like this campfire tale. The aliens turned off the lights. Well, no. The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street isn't
right.
about the aliens turning
right.
off the lights at all.
Right.
It's about something far darker that we can only explore in the context of a fairy tale.
Sure. Yeah.
That you like the fact that horror films are able to stretch all their imaginative muscles, because the minute a drama goes there, people walk out of the theater.
Right.
I mean, remember the now famous reaction to the end of A History of Violence.
Right, right.
And that really wasn't that non-realistic.
No,
or,
not at
or,
all. Not at all,
it
actually.
It wasn't that
no.
much of a stretch.
Right.
It was a really disturbing place to leave us,
right.
which is why
right.
the gentleman reacted that way. I have in front of me several reasons why people claim they like horror films.
All right.
And some of them are from this Fear in the Dark thing that we've talked about.
Right.
That I latched onto and illegally showed in class, because there's an actual disclaimer at the beginning. Do not, you cannot show this in a classroom. And yet, I thought it was important enough to. And the question that Fear in the Dark is asking is, if getting scared for real is unpleasant, why do people go to the movies to pay for the experience? Mm-hmm. So tell me which ones of these you agree with. And we'll make this fast, because I'm sure most of our listeners have entertained these before.
Agree with for me or for anyone?
For you.
Okay.
This episode is a psychoanalysis of you.
It's kind of
so
turning
out
perverse that way.
Do I find your response to the simple question, I don't necessarily go to horror films to be scared.
I did not think that was so crazy. Because I assumed you were more like me, because you'll go see any horror movie, like, and most of them aren't scary. So what keeps you going if...
Because we've discussed this, too.
No, I know.
Because you want it to be scary, and you so love it when it's scary, you're willing to sit through just the worst trash because you're chasing the dragon.
Yeah.
Here's the number one reason. It's beyond a cliche. That it's like a roller coaster. That man has built this machine that mimics violent death. Certainly, if you weren't in that little car, you'd be dead. And you get to experience this very exciting, very dangerous, very thrilling, very scary thing. And then at the end, you're brought back to the amusement park and everything's okay.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, that's the one that you always hear. Like, yeah. Oh, it allows you to deal with your fears of death and all that. I've never psychoanalyzed myself enough.
I think it's the woman who wrote Men, Women, and Chainsaws.
Carol Clover?
Very good.
Thank you.
I only could remember Carol. Because we're on a first name basis. That in one of the documentaries, she says, you always hear the roller coaster analogy, but no one ever says, well, why do you build a roller coaster?
right.
Which is the question we should be asking.
So let's look at this, because I'm in the middle of, hopefully by the time this podcast airs, I will have finished the article and it would have been published on F This Movie and people will have read it and loved it on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. Okay? Mm. I'm in the middle of trying to write something about that. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, is held up by many as the scariest movie ever made. Like, that and The Exorcist, I think, are the two that get thrown around. And many people call the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre a perfect horror movie, the best horror movie ever made. There's a handful that kind of get that distinction. And I've said this before, so this is not news. I prefer Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2 because it is way weirder and has all this weird comedy in it and this mix of tones and this very different energy. So to me, that kind of speaks to more what I'm interested in a horror movie. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a very real, very visceral experience. And the sequel is not. It is a crazy, gory cartoon.
And I agree, that speaks to more to what you're looking for. But could there be an analogy here? That part of your love for two is that you've seen one, and your viewing of two is being informed by one. Last week in class, I was doing some stuff about film noir, and I showed my students the film Blade Runner. And once again, I was confronted with the fact that no one likes the narration. Everyone shits on the narration. In the new final cut, the narration is gone, thank God. But almost everyone who says the narration was the worst thing on earth was informed by the narration because that's the version they originally saw.
Sure.
So as they're shitting on it, it's in the back of their heads and it's still informing them when they see the film. I don't like the narration either, but I think there's bits of the narration that work. Not all of it. There's way too much. And also lends another layer to the film that in its use of narration, it also makes it more like film noir,
right,
which frequently features first-person narration from the detective figure.
Had the narration been better written and delivered by a Harrison Ford who was not essentially protesting, I don't think we'd be complaining about the narration. I don't think it's the concept of narration that everyone objects to. I don't think. I could be wrong. It's that it's so heavy-handed and that he clearly hates saying it.
Could part of your reaction to two be based on the fact that you have one in the back of your head? I'm not suggesting that you don't like one better. All I'm saying is, and I'm not comparing the two films. In fact, in a weird way, I think they're so different.
No, yeah.
That it's apples and oranges.
Yes.
But part of your reaction to two is informed by the fact that there is this earlier film, and also there wouldn't be a two if it hadn't been for one.
Well, sure.
Two doesn't spring fully formed.
No.
Two might even be Toby Hooper's reaction to one and its attendant reception.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it absolutely is. In terms of my reaction to it, I think I was introduced to two even before one, so I don't know that it was... I don't know if I could exactly answer that question. I think it's very... I use it as an example because I think here you have essentially the same group of people telling the same story, more or less, two very different ways. And so I use it as an example just because I respond to them telling it this way as opposed to this way.
Sure.
Even though I think both ways are super valid and I have no complaints about the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But if I were interested primarily in being scared, that's the one that I would gravitate towards.
Sure. But also your love of two might speak to your love of things that are meta and more than one thing at once. As you yourself
Maybe.
Said.
Yeah.
The first one is one thing.
Yes.
It's one thing really well.
Yes.
Two, I saw it recently down here.
Probably.
Your birthday or scary movie night?
Maybe, yeah.
That there's at least three things going on in two.
Often in the same scene, which is, and again, this is trying at the basis of what I'm trying to say about it, that people are very put off by it because in the same scene, it's trying to do something funny, and then it has a crazy scare, and then there's a really disturbing image, and it's like, I don't know how to feel about all of these things happening at once.
And that's the reaction the filmmakers want. American filmgoers hate that. The story I always tell is something wild where people actually walked out when it stopped being a light screwball comedy. But we were talking earlier about restorations. I first saw the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the 53 Drive-In in a print that looked like they ran it across the sticky floor.
So you're supposed to see it, right?
Stepped on it. No, because it looked horrible.
Yeah.
And I remember when they cleaned that one up.
The 4K one that we went to?
What a revelation it was.
Yeah.
And then the first time I saw the original Last House on the Left, I couldn't figure out what anybody was talking about. And then I saw Fear in the Dark, which specifically talks about that film. And I'm sitting there saying, that wasn't in. The version I saw at the drive-in was missing at least 25 minutes.
Holy cow.
It was just cut to shit. And not cut to shit, oh, the projectionist took this footage home because he's saving it. It had been censored. It had been edited down.
Right.
And it was incomprehensible.
Wow.
And so I didn't get to see it. Could you like horror films, Patrick, moving on to number two? Because they are a psychic boot camp that help us deal with real-life fears.
Very possibly. I don't know. Like I said, I've never sat down. I've thought about it a lot, but never come up with an answer. Is me watching Jason Voorhees like cut up teenagers at Camp Crystal Lake really helping me cope with my own anxieties about death? Maybe. I don't think it would be, but maybe it is. So maybe that's part of what draws me to it.
And at this point, you bringing that up makes me wonder personally if I still have any anxieties about death left. Because the older I get, the more I'm going to be in that category of the sweet release of death.
To me, that's one of those answers, and maybe this isn't fair, but I brought this up earlier, this documentary Why Horror, and these answers that we're trying to find all of these answers are provided in this movie, and you get the same talking heads as in every horror documentary saying a lot of these same things. And none of those things have ever connected with me. Doesn't make them untrue, but I've never sat and watched one of these documentaries and heard George Romero or Wes Craven say, well, it helps us confront our own fears of death, and thought like, ooh, yes, that's it. That's what I'm looking for. That light bulb has never gone off for me. So I've never heard someone explain the appeal of horror movies in a way that connected with me.
Well, then we're going to hit it tonight.
All right.
I'm not
this is exciting.
My
this
list.
Is exciting.
The next one comes to us from none other than Wes Craven.
Okay.
And the first time I heard it, it made my head explode because I had never thought about it before. He said, famously, horror films do not create fear. They release fear. They're a vent. That we're walking around all the time with neurosis and anxieties, and horror films give us a socially acceptable way to get it out of our system. The Greek concept of catharsis.
Right. Again, do I think that that's a valid justification for why horror films work on large crowds? Yes. But for that to, I feel like, directly apply to my own experience, it would mean that I was getting worked up and afraid in a lot of these horror movies, and that's not what I'm feeling.
So when the film is over,
yeah,
you do not feel cleansed?
Not usually. I mean, sometimes, like...
Do you feel less likely to commit violent acts in your workaday life?
No. No, I'm always just as likely. There are some of those movies that do, like, Don't Breathe recently was like a ride, you know, and I got off and it wasn't like I'm less afraid of death or I've dealt with fears, but it was an emotional experience. It was like, this is suspenseful and release because they got away and, what's going to happen now? Okay, the Dawn of the Dead remake, I remember being like that. There's a sequence in a parking garage that was pretty tense and suspenseful, and like, so I certainly have had those experiences that are roller coastery in that way, but I don't know that I come out of them feeling cleansed so much as like, well, that was fun, you know what I mean?
Okay, but maybe it is the same emotion,
maybe,
but we're just calling it something else.
Maybe,
because if I go see something that's really good or really scary,
yeah,
when it's over,
yeah,
I feel great. John Goodman has a monologue in Matinee.
Oh, I love that.
Where
monologue.
He talks about,
it's like the best thing ever.
That at the end, you're alive, but you know that you are.
Right. No, it's the greatest.
Tom Gunning, who teaches at the University of Chicago, and it is one of my dreams that one day I will get to meet Mr. Gunning, because when I show The American Nightmare in class, and I've found this is true anytime you show a class a documentary year after year after year, there's certain talking heads that the kids instinctually, their ears pick up, and the minute someone says something that's actually thought-provoking and not nonsense or something that actually applies to their lives, they're like, oh, he's the good one, and they perk up. I've mentioned that John Carpenter frequently does the same thing, but Gunning teaches at the University of Chicago, and in The American Nightmare, he suggests the following. I think this one might apply to you. That in our modern 21st century life, there is too much going on. Just name the different number of inputs and stimuli and things that are vying for our attention. And also, there's a lot of anxiety and neurosis, and it takes many different forms. Gunning suggests that in order for us to exist, we have to shut things off and go through life with tunnel vision and blinders on, because if we didn't, we would go crazy or commit a crime or be unable to live a life that we would want. That you have to focus on your family and your job and other responsibilities and maybe things like grocery shopping and cooking food, and it's a certain myopia. But Gunning goes on to suggest that there's something inside of us that knows that that's inherently limiting, and we desire a more, I don't want to say total, but that we desire something more, that we desire something that is stimulating us on a caveman level, and that for the 2 hours we're in the movie theater, we take our blinders off and we're allowing ourselves to be overstimulated.
Maybe. That of all the ones that you've mentioned, that sounds the closest to something that I can identify with, in terms of the ways that horror movies try to stimulate you in all of their different iterations. You know, one of the things I love about horror is just how varied the genre is. And oh, okay. So you could watch one movie that's like this and one movie that's completely different, but they both fall under this umbrella of horror, you know.
But that I think for both of us, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, horror of all the genres that we watch and enjoy might be the one that's most enveloping. I think I'm mispronouncing that.
Enveloping?
Yes, as an adjective. That they surround us and get under our skin more than any other genre. And so that would lend credence to Gunning's.
Maybe.
Admittedly, in The American Nightmare, they accompany his explanation with these crazy visuals and stuff that make the point. I got one more.
All right.
This is from the Coen brothers.
Okay.
Maybe this will hit it on the head. They said between the two of them, they tend to prefer films that are peppy. The example they use is Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho.
Okay.
That, and again, I'm interpreting the Coen brothers' words. Could it be as simple as that? And this goes back to your comment earlier about imagination, that horror films are simply more.
Sure.
That they stretch the boundaries of imagination. Right. They don't feel as earthbound, that they tend to be, I don't want to say fast, but they tend to be stimulating and
right.
and a ride. And at first, the first time I read that in an interview, I thought they were sort of joking around,
yeah,
as they want to do. But the more I thought about it, I thought, well, no, that they may have hit the nail, yeah, on the head. They are peppy.
Yeah. And again, that speaks to not just why I like horror movies, but also I think the kinds of horror movies that I like, and this goes back to that conversation with Doug, where he's very much, I don't like that a lot of horror movies get a bad rap because they show stuff, that all of a sudden the skill is to not show anything. Well, it's great because they realize they don't have to show you all that gore and stuff to be scary. It's like, you're right, they don't have to, but there's no fucking crime in doing
it. No. And I'm glad that both types exist,
right?
Because there's a good way to show it.
Right.
And a bad way to never show us anything.
Exactly. And so the reason I bring that up is because, you know, more of everything, even within horror, sometimes I don't respond as much to the ones that are less. Do you know what I mean? I think there's a talent in not showing anything, but I would much rather watch something fucking crazy, right, than the others.
And what you just said, because again, I cannot express anything in my own words. I have to quote someone else. In Fear in the Dark, Clive Barker says, "I have no patience with the type of film where in the first half hour we see a footprint, and then in the second half hour we see a claw, and then in the last 5 minutes we see the monster before they destroy it." He said, "The monster is the reason I'm here."
Right. And again, there's always the exceptions that give people who are dismissive of the genre license to say no. Jaws, right? Well, they didn't show the shark for the first hour and a half of Jaws. It's like, you're right. In that instance, they didn't, and it really worked. But that doesn't mean that every movie can get away with playing that game.
No, I agree.
And again, movies like The Haunting or The Blair Witch or whatever, they give license
but
to
those,
people to
those
say
are exceptions.
Exactly. But
as Stephen King points out, eventually you have to open the door.
Right.
You have to.
Right.
That's the game.
Right.
And that The Haunting, the good one, and maybe The Innocents are exceptions.
Right.
There's not that many of those.
Right.
I want to see Godzilla. What was my objection to the Godzilla remake?
Right.
There's
right.
no Godzilla.
And I think, if we're going to run with this idea of more, because that's the closest that anyone has ever gotten. So congratulations. By the end of the podcast, you did it. I think as we were talking about this, I was thinking of where I said, like, I'd rather watch something fucking crazy than the others, right? And the movie that popped into my head was The Beyond, because we kind of used it for a lot of our branding for Scary Movie Month on the Facebook page and Twitter and stuff like that. I think some of that speaks to my sort of recent, by recent I mean the last few years, kind of love affair of all things Italian horror, because it's so much more. It's more and then more on top of more. It bears no resemblance to reality. In fact, the closer it gets to reality, the more it sort of fails.
And I would argue, as someone who likes those films less,
right,
that's the only way to enjoy them.
Right, right.
Because clearly,
if that's the thing I'm chasing,
that's the point.
Right.
Yeah.
If you like carbonation, you want the fizziest drink. You know? So... If that is indeed the thing I'm chasing, that speaks to why I've kind of become drawn to those movies.
And I would agree, and I think we should close on this, that horror films are the fizziest drink. Because I agree with that.
Yeah.
I've been debating for the last couple of years, because I'm getting on in years and I'm an old hippie or something. I've been thinking about getting a tattoo. But I can't figure out what to get.
Yeah.
Because it's for good.
Right. You got one shot.
Right. And you don't want to get one. And then the next week, oh, God damn it. Because clearly that leads to multiple tattoos, which I don't want to do. Horror is the fizziest drink. I might get a tattoo that says that.
Then you have to explain it to everyone or just provide them a link to this podcast. Maybe tattoo the URL right underneath it.
Say, horror is the fizziest drink, www.fthismovie.net.
Well, hopefully this conversation was fun for everyone to listen to. I think it was. I enjoyed it.
So did I.
Yeah, it was fun.
This was great.
Yeah. Thank you guys very much for listening. Continue to post your 7-word reviews at fthismovie.net. Follow us on the Twitter at fthismovie. Like us on the Facebook, and you can email us on the email.
And you can download it on the iTunes
right.
Or the Stitcher.
Our email is
fthismovie. Which was my nickname for my grandmother.
The Stitcher. She was a surgeon. fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com is our email. Thank you very much, J Bones. This was fun.
I agree.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.